From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, an Indianapolis cabaret artist tries his luck in the Big Apple. A physician profiles inspirational Hoosiers, and we learn about a new storefront theater. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You won't want to miss a word right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and on today's program, we'll hear about the collaboration of two longtime Indianapolis museums. But first, we often think that universities take a break and rest a bit over summer vacation, but that's certainly not the case for Heron School of Art and Design personnel, as I learned during my recent conversation with Heron Gallery's director Max Weintraub and artist Jacqueline Cedar. So, Max, I want to start with you. Sometimes we think that universities and art schools in particular take the summer to sit back and take a breath and catch up on stuff. You're going full tilt.
Yeah, well, it's my first full summer here in Indianapolis, and I'm really excited to sort of get into some of the meat of my programming and at the galleries. And so it just seemed like a really great opportunity to sort of push the envelope a little bit with a couple shows that are diverse, but also that are, I think going to be really compelling. And, while it does get a little quieter when we don't have the students around at Heron, the public is always welcome. And so it's just a great opportunity to try some new things.
Jacqueline, tell me about your involvement with your summer installation.
Sure. Well, I'm here for 2 weeks. I'm making a wall painting that covers the entirety of the Marsh Galleries, and I shipped 8 paintings here and 2 sculptures, and I'm really excited for the figures to become part of the environment.
And had you seen the space before, or at least photographs of the space?
Just in pictures,
okay.
Yeah.
And was there something about the space that informed what you created to go in the space?
Well, I've always been engaged with figures that behave gesturally through expression and interact with each other. So a lot of the work that I shipped here I knew would involve that content. And then the space is really kind of happening now or being built up in response to the work that I shipped here.
Hmm.
So a lot of the images that I'm painting are mirroring the paintings that exist in the room.
So say a little bit more about how the art pieces mirror one another or in a less literal way, reflect one another,
yeah.
Relate to one another, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think the figures, they all have sort of psychological relationships that are set up via their physical forms. And the paintings that I'm making on the wall right now are actually like direct representations of these figures. So if there's a face on one side of the room, it's being represented on the opposite side. And so they're kind of populating in that way.
How do you want viewers to feel when they experience that?
Immersed, and as if they could engage with the figures and be sort of surrounded by the environment.
Hmm. What led you to painting in the first place?
Always been interested in people and the way that they behave, and I think making a life-size figure has always been a way for me to allow for the audience to feel like they could engage directly physically with the work. And now the sculptures are kind of taking that to a new end.
Do you ever catch people talking to your work?
No, but I'd love to see that. What I'd love to see is people starting to kind of try to get into the way that sculpture and art often mirrors humans, it's fun to think about humans mirroring the art.
Max, can you hide a microphone or a webcam in there?
A webcam, for sure. And we've actually been documenting Jackie's process as she sort of paints the walls of the gallery, and it's already looking really incredible, and her sort of oversized figures are just really dramatic and stylized, and I think viewers will really get a kick out of them.
Speaking of psychology,
A Lot of Sorrow. Tell us about A Lot of Sorrow, which seems to be an interesting companion piece to Mirror, Mirror.
Yeah, A Lot of Sorrow is the name of a piece by the Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson, and he collaborated with the indie rock band The National. And Ragnar is known for his sort of endurance-based art performances. And A Lot of Sorrow pushes that to the limit. It's a six-hour performance by The National, and Ragnar asks them to perform live on stage at MoMA PS1 in New York City. And the video is a document of that, where The National played their sort of pop ballad, Sorrow, continuously and repeatedly for over 6 hours. And Ragnar's work is often interested in exploring the sort of creative possibilities that come out of repetition and out of endurance. And so this is this kind of wonderful, immersive, large format video installation that I think audiences will really enjoy.
Are you going to get a chance to come back for the opener?
I'm hoping I'll be able to come back. I haven't just looked at the dates yet, but I'd love to be able to see all of these shows.
Yeah, because among other things, I'd love to have you see A Lot of Sorrow and paint in response to it. That would be so cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that's another work that is going to be completely immersive and exciting for an audience to feel a part of.
Yeah.
And both works are really dealing with sort of enduring, timeless artistic themes, whether it's the sort of, you know, our inner selves that are sort of manifested through Jackie's characters, or these ideas of sort of, you know, loss and sort of sorrow that Ragnar and The National are exploring with. So even though these are really contemporary exhibitions that are dealing, you know, sort of the moment and of the time, I think they're also tapping into artistic traditions that go back centuries.
Which is so important on the campus of an art school.
Yeah, especially at Heron. And, you know, we're always trying to appeal to diverse audiences. And I think that these shows, like hopefully most of our shows, there's going to be something for everyone in them, and we'll certainly challenge our students to see things and see things differently, which is really what art is all about.
And I'll mention just briefly, because you're going to hear more about it on a future edition of The Art of the Matter, but Fold Staple Riot, Art and Sculpture of Zine Making is the third part of the First Friday experience. And for somebody who's like, zine, I used to know what that meant. What is a zine?
Yeah, a zine is really a sort of lo-fi, do-it-yourself, self-published magazine. The term zine comes from magazine. And really, it's part of a broader sort of concept that how I think about art, which is that art really needs to be relevant in order to be transformative. And so the art and subculture of zines and zine making is really tapping into a part of art making and self-publishing that often doesn't get much attention from museums and galleries. It's certainly getting more in recent years, but this show, I think, will really show the diverse practices that are out there, the diverse themes, the broad themes that are addressed, and the different sort of stylistic approaches by local, regional, and national zine makers. So it should be really exciting, and we're looking forward to working with Glue Stick Festival to make it a great opening event.
Jackie, last question is for you. How do you know when you're done with this exhibition?
Well, I work very responsively, so I haven't planned out any of the work that I'm making right now. I've just started from one end, and I'm kind of building from there. And I think once the wall painting is done, I'll be able to set the other objects in place. And it's really a feeling. I work very intuitively.
Artist Jacqueline Cedar and Heron School of Art and Design Gallery's director Max Weintraub. You can find out all about their summer exhibitions and activities at heron.iupui.edu. That's Heron, heron.iupui.edu. And come out for First Friday on July 7th to see for yourself. And we'll learn more about their Glue Stick Festival in a couple of weeks. For years, our city's been home to a rich and varied collection of more than 900 works of art, including drawings, paintings, sculptures, and more, all of them depicting sports. Now the National Art Museum of Sport will permanently reside inside the new Ephraimson Pavilion at the Riley Children's Health Sports Legends Experience at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. If you've been wondering what all that construction around 32nd and Meridian Streets is about, that's part of the excitement, as contributor Pete Brown learned when he spoke with the Children's Museum's president, Jeff Patchen.
So the National Art Museum of Sport, I was reading, started in New York City, actually.
It did.
Can you
tell
me?
In the 50s.
Okay. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
1959, started by Germaine Glidden, who was an artist himself, but an avid collector of sport art. And as I understand it, one of the first formal exhibitions was in Madison Square Garden of this collection. And then a number of the various Olympics portions of the collection were put on display, and then came here for the Pan Am Games in the late 80s, stayed in a bank building here, okay, here in what is now the Chase Tower, Salesforce Tower, and then to the campus of IUPUI in the Conference Center, I think from 94 through 2012. And then when the IUPUI did the renovation of the conference center, the collection had to be put into storage. So it's been in storage in the basement of the NCAA, courtesy of the NCAA and having the space to hold it there for them.
Well, I know I've seen some of their collection there at their headquarters.
Yeah, and actually some pieces from the – they actually have had a loan relationship with the National Art Museum of Sport, so they could put some of the wonderful works of art in the halls of the NCAA National Headquarters.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic collection. Yeah, well, and a collection of over 900 works ranging from drawing, painting, sculpture, kind of you name it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's photographs, drawings, paintings, sculptures. There's some wonderful small Inuit First People sculpture of Inuit sport. There is, of course, works by Leroy Neiman and Winslow Homer, George Bellows, even a piece by Muhammad Ali.
Wow.
So by athletes themselves, which is cool.
Well, and I don't know if the stars just align, but it doesn't seem like there could be a more perfect marriage with the opening of the Sports Legends Experience coming up.
Well, we're really excited about that marriage, because it brings the arts and the humanities and the social cultural context of sport to our project, and so it will be a 3,000 square foot addition to the Legends Pavilion, which will allow us to have three different small galleries. One gallery will be from the permanent collection. Another part of the gallery will be changing exhibitions, and a third area will be a studio where parents, grandparents, and kids and grandkids can draw, paint, and sculpt inspired by the works of art in the collection.
Yeah, that's fantastic. When it comes to the definition of art of sport, how do you define sport? What are some of these sports that appear in the collection?
That's a great question, Pete, because the caretakers of this collection saw sport in its broadest context.
Sure.
So you've got swimming, but it's bathers, kind of the social aspect of that. It's a Winslow Homer piece. You've got fishing in the same way, sailing, equestrian, obviously football, basketball, baseball, hockey, soccer, all of that, biking. So it's a very broad, and then First People sports, like I mentioned with the Inuit sculpture, where sport is part of the culture growing up.
Over the last 15 years that I've been bringing my kids and my family here, there's so many great interactives, so many great programs, such fantastic space. How does the concept of fine art really plug into the mission here at the Children's Museum?
Well, part of our mission is to create these extraordinary learning experiences across the sciences, arts, and humanities. It's right in our mission statement.
Sure.
And so with this particular, bringing the National Art Museum of Sport here, it really is bringing a fine art lens to the world of sport, which is part of the National Art Museum of Sport's mission statement, is to collect and promote fine art about sport.
So, well, and so many times I think people consider themselves art people or sports people. right? Right. There are a lot of people that kind of draw a line in the sand, and I think this collection is going to help bring them together.
It will, and it also will help from a fine art education perspective, helping kids and adults understand how do artists draw, paint, sculpt action. How do they commemorate a famous, a special moment in sports, whether it's victory, defeat, you know, timeout to the penalty box, kind of all those kinds of moments in sports that are unique to the world of sports, and how do you depict those in drawing, painting, sculpture, photography, etc.
Contributor Pete Brown with Jeff Patchen, president of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. You can learn lots more at childrensmuseum.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and later this hour, profiles of inspirational Hoosiers born or made. But first, Eat Drink Indy's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with the Indianapolis Art Center's Tim Compton. He's custom designing and making the serving pieces for an upcoming dinner, making them to go with specific foods, and then some of the food will be designed to fit the plates, a real intersection of art and food.
So we're talking with Tim Compton of the Indianapolis Art Center, a ceramic artist, and we're going to be talking about the intersection of art and food. So first of all, Tim, tell me a little bit about what you do as an artist or craftsperson, whatever you prefer.
I tend to walk that line. I think ceramics as a medium has walked that line for quite some time. You know, it was born out of the necessity to have items to eat off of, to store food, and that kind of stuff. And
so a practical background.
Exactly. Right. But, you know, I did go to art school, and I had all of that background as well, learned art history and all that kind of stuff. And it allowed me to kind of implement some of those different aspects into the functional work that I make. So what I tell a lot of people is that I make decorative functional work, which is kind of that little asterisk off to the side there. But some items that I make are not necessarily the most practical, but the goal is to kind of make the user think about how that piece of equipment is interacting with the activity that they're doing. So
For an example.
Yeah, if it's at a dinner setting, you know, the bowl might not be perfectly round-shaped. It might have lobes to it or something that can maybe interrupt the use of with the utensil. I make a lot of mugs that are out of the round shape, and for a lot of people, that's really unusual to drink out of something that's not perfectly round because
That's sort of unusual. That's something that, you know, we take for granted, and we pick up a glass or a cup, and it's going to be round.
Yeah, and a mug is an incredibly intimate item to use. You know, you're actually putting it in your mouth. And so that is on a very personal level with a lot of people. And so when it's become something that's a little bit uncomfortable, it's very much something that they notice.
Oh, no, I hadn't thought about that. But it is. It is an intimate sort of thing. And actually, you know, food is, you know, a very intimate thing. A meal is very intimate. So describe a little bit more some of the serving pieces. One that caught my eye at a recent show was a bowl, but it wasn't exactly bowl-shaped.
Yeah, so that was sort of a triangulated bowl, and it had sort of a sweeping curve across the rim, as well as a texture on the inside. So all of those are things that are going to affect the way that somebody eats out of that bowl and maybe make them consider how they're consuming that item or maybe a little bit uncomfortable while they're consuming that item and make them sort of enjoy that experience and think about it a little bit more.
Well, now talk about being uncomfortable and yet enjoying the experience more.
Exactly.
How does that work?
Yeah, that's always the balance. You know, you don't want to – I did make a series of work that was sort of over the line as far as that uncomfort level, and then people end up shying away from it. One of my favorite things to do is to put a variety of dishes in front of people and let them make choices, and it's always interesting to hear why they choose one item over the other. But there is a level of comfort and familiarity that needs to be associated with a dish as well, because you don't want to take it so far that they're preoccupied with it and it detracts from the actual meal. So it's a striking a balance with a lot of that kind of stuff. But the idea is that the dish will enhance the meal, to enhance the experience, to make it more memorable. And I think the successful work that walks that line and does that is really the work that I'm the most proud of.
Well, now tell me a little bit about, you know, how dishware, how serving pieces, you know, can walk that line. What is too uncomfortable?
I think it depends a little bit on the person. I have experienced a wide variety of dishes, and I feel like I've been very fortunate to have an eclectic mix. And so I might be a little bit more tolerant of some dishes than others. But somebody that's used to dinerware,
A plain white plate,
exactly,
for example.
The plain white plate. They might just the matter of putting it into a different color or putting it into adding a design or a pattern to that might change the way that they react to that piece. One of my favorite things to do is have imagery or items that are almost discovered as the food is consumed.
You mean the things that are underneath the food,
exactly,
as part of the plate or
yeah,
piece?
So then as they're eating that, they're discovering more about what that dish is and kind of what's there. And so it's always interesting. Every once in a while, I'll get somebody that will flip a dish over after they're done eating out of it, which is I always consider sort of the biggest compliment because they're so curious about the piece that they're eating out of that they've been thinking about it as they've been eating that food, and they're going to remember that meal and they're going to remember that time and probably conversations that were happening around that time. And all of it works together to kind of enhance the experience.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. In the world of acting, storefront theater is a generic term for, well, exactly what it sounds like, a place to stage plays that was actually built for retail. Indianapolis is home to a new company that calls itself Storefront Theater, and Jill Dittmeyer has more. Hi.
Hi, Sharon. Ronan Mara spent 14 years in Chicago running his own small ensemble, which did productions in what he calls the storefront style.
Purposely intimate and ensemble-based work, you know, usually with smaller casts, but you never know. And with a complete focus on new work. Not necessarily world premieres, but, you know, something that's been produced once somewhere else that I'm going to bring to Indianapolis and whatnot. And on top of that, our focus in terms of what we're going to be programming are going to be plays by women, minorities, and foreign playwrights. You know, from, like, the first play we're doing, Infinity, by Hannah Moskovitz. She's a Canadian playwright. You know, not stuff from like New York, not pulling in those, you know, those plays, but from different areas and different countries. So we bring something unique and new here.
And how do you go about selecting the unique and new?
My primary resources for that, there's especially these days, there's phenomenal resources. There's a big one is the National New Play Network. They have the New Play Exchange, and you can literally filter every possible thing you could be looking for a play. Another one that I'm a big fan of is a list called the Kilroys. The Kilroys are a group of female writers. They put together this group that that gets people to read and identify via through other producers, artistic directors, literary managers, their recommendations by plays by women. And they send them in, and then they go through all of those. And then at the end of that cycle, they put out on their website their winners for that list and then all of the runners up. But also, you know, you see, like I said, it doesn't have to be a world premiere. So if you see, you know, if I see something open wherever, say Minnesota, you know, that might be something, you know, and I read the review of it or whatever, that I might poke around and see what that play is all about.
I would think new work would be exciting to local actors here as well.
Yes, always. Always. I have never, ever met an actor that was not enthused to do new work.
How do you get people that are not used to being a small audience seeing a very up-close and personal kind of show? How do you make them feel comfortable and get them to come see those
and
productions?
Get them to come. Well, it's not, first of all, I should be very clear that I'm not a huge fourth wall breaker with my shows, and there's not a lot of, and there's absolutely no, like, direct physical contact or anything like that with the audience. They're close, but they're not going to be right up to them. You know, in fact, anytime I'm in a 50-seater, the thing that's really compelling to me is how close you're sitting to the audience member next to you, you know, and that's tight sometimes. But you just, I don't know. I've never run into a problem with somebody being uncomfortable in that situation. And I, more often than not, I get into, you know, I hear, when this is the goal, how visceral it is to be that close, to be able to see the whites of an actor's eyes, to see them sweating, you know, and it keeps you from having, when you're in that kind of a space, it frees up blocking. You know, you don't have to counter the way you do in a big proscenium necessarily. People can get truly up close and personal, and I think there's a lot of appreciation. There's appreciation for that from the audience, and that they really, that it's a way to connect with the performances, and that in a deeper way, I think, sometimes than you can in a larger space. I've not really met anybody that had any difficulty with that, though. You know, outside of, you know, you're sitting right next to somebody and they're coughing or opening their candy. So.
Financially, how do you make that go, though? When we have fewer seats, do you have to have higher ticket prices, more performances?
Well, a little bit of all of that. My ticket prices for this here are going to be a little bit higher than I had them in Chicago for that reason. But of course, you know, your ticket sales are only, for the most part, going to cover about 25% of your budget, you know, for the show. But the thing is, though, is that you can also keep your operating costs lower with it, too. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm only planning on doing two shows a year and things like that, because it is smaller. You never scrimp on the design or anything like that, but there is overall less space and usually less actors to costumes and whatnot. And you can keep the budgets in general lower, too, and putting the money in the most important places, making sure it's going to the people that are doing it, and trying to keep those costs low so that you can keep the ticket prices reasonable as well.
Now, their first production will be in September. They're going to hold it at the Indie Fringe Theater in that beautiful, that small, intimate Indie 11 Theater. So it's a perfect spot for that storefront kind of style. But Ronan says he would like to find a permanent home in downtown Indianapolis and eventually offer two shows per season.
Well, speaking of shows, we have some shows and lots of other things on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, there's still some wonderful things going on down at the Tube Factory down there near Garfield Park on Cruft Street. And it's still in conjunction with the current exhibit by Chicago artist Carlos Rolon that's all about boxing. And I had the opportunity to go take a look at it on this last First Friday, and it's amazing. This past First Friday, they had live boxing going on in one of the small galleries. They're going to have live boxing once again coming up on July the 7th. In the main gallery, they have Carlos Rolon's main exhibit, which is this contemporary interpretation of boxing. He uses rhinestone. He uses gold leaf. He uses wallpaper.
Wow.
He uses all kinds of things. It sounds very strange, but it's absolutely spectacular and nothing that you would associate with boxing. He also has reimagined his childhood basement home where they used to watch boxing on television. And you walk into this room and you feel like you are stepping back in time. And you can step back in time on June the 10th there as well. They're going to be showing Raging Bull, the movie with Robert De Niro about boxing, on June the 10th at 9 o'clock. And then again on June the 14th, they're going to be sharing a bunch of short stories from Hemingway, specifically some of his boxing-oriented stories from 6:30 to 8 p.m. So a must-see, must-do for June. Head down to the Tube Factory.
Fantastic. Well, you can head back a few centuries in time for the Richmond Shakespeare Festival, which is including in its summer season Cymbeline and Merry Wives of Windsor from June 16th through July 1st.
And also, DK ended their 45th season with Dance as a Contact Sport, a wonderful series of shows that really does prove once again that dancers are athletes. And if you want to learn about dance or your kids want to learn about dance, they are offering camps for kids and adults all summer long. They start in the month of June. Go to their website, dancecal.org, to find out more information on learning how to become an athletic dancer.
Hey, if you are a fan of A Prairie Home Companion, guess what? You're a bluegrass fan, whether you know it or not. And you might want to take that to the next level by checking out Bill Monroe's Bean Blossom Bluegrass Festival, June 10th through the 17th. If you're like, I've even heard of that, it's the world's oldest continuous running bluegrass festival. This is its 51st year. It's at the Bill Monroe Music Park and Campground, and it really is family friendly, and bluegrass comprises a remarkable range of styles, and there's something for everybody, including the chance to try out a bluegrass instrument and get your jam on. So again, Bill Monroe's Bean Blossom Bluegrass Festival, June 10th through the 17th.
We all love free, and down at the Greenwood Park Mall, they have kicked off their summer concert series every Thursday night starting at 6:30 by the outdoor fountain on the mall's north side. Get everything from blues to cover music to even Henry Lee Summer is going to be showing up one night this summer on a Thursday night down there in Greenwood.
A free outdoor concert at the Carmel Gazebo is coming up June 16th. That's a Friday night at 7 o'clock. The Indiana Wind Symphony will be joined by a group of select high school musicians playing alongside them, and you'll enjoy well-known pieces like Beauty and the Beast, America the Beautiful, and Stars and Stripes Forever. Classical concert, but also a good one to grab those younger kids in your life and get them exposed to good music early on.
And coming up on June the 24th at the Sieberling Mansion in Kokomo, Hoosier photographer Matthew Carroll, who's actually lived all around the world, has been taking pictures of Kokomo, and he's going to be displaying them, and they'll be up there for several weeks, but a great way to see an outsider's insider look at a small Indiana town.
Mini golf at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. It's back after its wildly successful first year with artist-designed holes. And there's an adult beverage and some food available for purchase, so don't be super serious when you keep score. Mini golf at the IMA runs through September 2nd.
And if we haven't given you enough ideas to get out and about, you can learn more by checking out the local arts events at theindiearts.org/guide. That's at the Arts Council of Indianapolis's website. Or join us again next week. We'll be back with more on the calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and in a few minutes, an Indianapolis cabaret artist takes on the Big Apple. But right now, one of the benefits of celebrating our state's bicentennial is learning more about the lesser-known but remarkable history of our state and its amazing people. Some of the greatest athletes, composers, entertainers, entrepreneurs, innovators, leaders, musicians, philanthropists, politicians, preachers, public servants, scientists, teachers, and writers in U.S. history have been nurtured by this soil. Indianapolis physician Dr. Richard Gunderman wrote a series of profiles of these so-called Hoosier Beacons for the Indianapolis Business Journal, and they've now been collected in a book. I invited Dr. Gunderman to tell me about how he chose his subjects. Where did the idea of writing about these notable Hoosiers come from?
I get to talk a lot with high school and grade school age students, and I'm shocked, continually shocked, by how little young people know about the important figures from their own home state of Indiana. I don't think it's any worse than it was when I was in school. You could have given me the test at the end of this book. I'm sure I would have flunked. But in the meantime, I've had an opportunity to learn about them, and now I'm convinced it's something worth others learning about as well.
And I want you to give us the definition of how you decided who could be included in this book, because not everybody was born here.
You're absolutely right. I think it's people who were either born here, educated or grew up here, perhaps chose at some later point in their life to live here. But I think they were people who thought the time they spent in Indiana played an important role in enabling them to contribute not only to the state of Indiana, but to our nation and sometimes to humankind generally.
Mm-hmm. And the people in this book, who, of course, are the people you profiled for the IBJ over the last, about 2 years?
About a year.
They're entrepreneurs, they're public servants, they're pioneers, explorers. They're a little bit of everything. Was it hard to decide who to leave out?
It absolutely was. As soon as I turned in the manuscript for this book, I was asked when Volume 2 would appear. So, you know, I don't claim to have selected the 32 most important Hoosiers, but I'm very confident that each of these 32 Hoosiers is a very interesting human being who, though having pursued very diverse paths in life, all have something to teach us.
Now, I know that the intent is for us to consume each person as a separate individual and to think, okay, without that persistence, she wouldn't have gotten that far. Without being willing to take a risk, he wouldn't have invented that. Is there any kind of a through line as you look back on these nearly three dozen people that you would say this is what constitutes a Hoosier value, or these are the core Hoosier values?
I think what you indicated is absolutely correct. Many of these individuals overcame great adversity in life. You know, parents who died when they were very young, very straitened economic circumstances. Some of them were orphans, yet they had some clarity of purpose, some vision that guided them through those dark hours. And obviously, eventually, they were able to triumph over circumstances.
How did writing about researching and then writing about these folks change you?
I think it's made me appreciate much more deeply the rich legacy we enjoy as Hoosiers. I think we leave, most of us, pretty comfortable lives. We're fairly well off, well educated. This is a beautiful state. We're fortunate to live here. It helped me appreciate the sacrifices that had been made in generations past that enable us to enjoy these lives. And I have the feeling that if we get to know our predecessors a little better, it may help us clarify our own aspirations in life as individuals, as families, neighborhoods, even as a whole state.
You and your wife have children. Were they part of a test case as you were writing about these folks?
Yeah, we talked about many of these individuals at the dinner table because I was so intrigued and fascinated by what I was finding as I delved into these lives that I would very often offer sort of impromptu presentations, and that would get a discussion started that turned out to be very fruitful in its own right.
Dr. Richard Gunderman is the author of Hoosier Beacons, a collection of profiles of many of the most influential people with ties to Indiana. The book was published by the IBJ Press. By day, Roger Schmeltzer is an insurance industry executive, but at night and on the weekends, you can find him practicing a completely different craft, cabaret. He's performed in Indy, of course, and in Chicago, and his debut CD, About Now, was issued a few years ago. But next week, Roger will perform at New York City's Metropolitan Room, where he's directed by Marilyn May. I invited him to tell me about the concert. What attracted you to singing in the first place? Not just cabaret singing, but singing.
My dad sang avocationally. He used to sing a really silly song about peeling an onion at his yeah, I've never been able to find that song.
Do you remember a little of it?
All I remember is that he would dress in a chef's outfit and actually cry. And he would do this at the Western Electric Talent Show every year, and it was a big hit. I've got pictures of it, but I don't have the song.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I wish I could remember.
And you had no choice.
That's true.
Was your mom musically inclined?
No, my mom was pretty shy, but very supportive.
Yeah. Somebody has to be the audience.
That's right.
So there's a little bit of a gap between seeing your parent do something entertaining and deciding to go down that path yourself.
Yeah, a little bit of a gap, but I sang in choirs, you know, all throughout school and grade school up until college. And then I was in a couple of musicals right around the end of my senior year in high school and freshman year in college. And then there was a real gap. I gave it up for about 16 years and then started up again in the early 90s.
What lured you back?
I just had an opportunity. I was finished with law school, mm-hmm. and I was offered a part in a play, And I took it, and it wasn't a musical, but I just wanted to do that. And then that led me to right back into it. You know, you think you're out, and then you're back in.
Was it, in fact, like getting back on a bike? Did it all come? Did all the technique come back to you immediately? Or
well, from on a stagecraft side, yes. I remembered what stage right and stage left was, and I knew how to do all those things, and knew not to block people or to be blocked and things like that. Mm-hmm. Musically, though, I learned a huge amount starting in the early 90s when I actually was doing things that were of a higher stake and a higher quality, and they were all here in Indianapolis. But that's really, you know, how I got back to it. And I learned a lot about how to act a song. I mean, when you're doing it as part of musical theater, it's just dialogue anyway, set to music. And what I've really enjoyed is being able to take that into more of an intimate setting, not the actual show setting.
Sure. You've carved out a wonderful niche. At first blush, it looks like Great American Songbook, mm-hmm. but it kind of is and isn't. You've kind of made a specialty of discovering some amazing music that hasn't been recorded 1,000 times.
I like that because you can always compare everything else to everyone else.
Sure.
You know, everybody knows what Night and Day by Frank Sinatra sounds like.
Yeah.
So I have tried to find other things. But what I have also discovered is that when you do a show for people, they don't always, and they don't know you, they don't always want to hear things that they don't know. So that's pushed me back toward the Great American Songbook, because those are songs that people, if you do them right, if you do them with your unique interpretation and arrangement, it is like a brand new song.
Mm-hmm. Now, You sent me a couple of tracks, new tracks, and I was thinking about and playing your album that came out. How long ago did About Now come out?
About 8 years ago.
Wow, that was fast. And you have a different, there's a different feeling, a little bit looser sound, yeah. A little bit airier sound. To what do you attribute that?
I'm just more confident. I've done it a lot more since then. I actually sung live a lot more in the last 8 years. And I'm just confident in the material and confident in my ability to deliver the material. When you record something, and that was my first recording, it's nerve-wracking. I mean, you want to get it right. You know, you can't just move from one song to the next song. You got to play back the one you just did, and you just want to get it right because you know it's there forever. And now I've done some additional recording, which you have heard, and I like that what you said. Yes, it is looser, it is airier. I just feel like it's like here it is, baby. Like it or
here
lump
I am.
It. Here I am. Better way to say that.
And in fact, isn't that kind of what creating a cabaret show is? Is creating a story arc about something about you, or is it about a persona?
I think it's about a message. I think it's less, and to the extent I can bring something to the message, that's what I want to do. In this particular case, I've been focusing a lot lately on trying to find songs that actually make people feel a little more confident in their lives, a sense of stability.
Hmm.
I think we really need that right now. It's just the message as much as anything else for me.
What is the role of a great shaper, mentor, director like Marilyn May?
It's hard to express.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. She's a tremendous person and has a fantastic life story of her own and is a big star.
Yeah.
But you don't feel that way when you're with her. You feel like you're with your sister or your mother or just somebody you've known all your life. And what she does is she figures out what you do well. What's the right key? What's the right persona? What are the songs that suit you? And what is that arc of your message? I mean, how will you express it? And those things are just invaluable. The other thing she does, which builds incredible confidence, is you can speak right up to her and say, you know, I don't really want to do it that way. I want I don't want as much romance in this, or I want more romance in that. Mm-hmm. And she says, okay, let's figure that out. Yeah, she's terrific. She's been a real godsend.
Are you taking a little posse with you to New York for your debut?
Little posse.
A big posse.
And my whole family will be there with the exception of my youngest son and his girlfriend. They will be with me. I think there will be some other Indianapolis folks who are coming to New York. You know, people are always looking for an excuse to go to New York, and we give them two excuses.
Are you nervous?
Not really. I probably ought to be, huh? I'm really not nervous. I'm very excited and looking forward to it a lot.
Roger Smeltzer will make his New York City debut on Sunday, June 18th, with a reprise performance on Tuesday, June 20th, at the Metropolitan Room. A Little Bit Closer to You is part of the set list for the show called Heart Songs. You can find Roger's CD About Now on CD Baby.
I have to tell you something serious. But don't be alarmed.
Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
Oh, man, what's that false beat out here? Hey, man.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and today I'm going to be sharing five songs from the great Indianapolis soul music record label, Lamp Records. And I'm excited to pass the word along that Lamp Records co-founder Herb Miller will receive a Nouveau Cultural Vision Award on behalf of all the amazing Indianapolis soul music his label documented. The 18th annual Nouveau Cultural Vision Awards are happening on June 14th at 6 p.m. at Center Point Brewing. And the event is free and open to the public, so please come out. In the late 1960s, Miller co-founded Lamp Records. The Indianapolis soul-based label recorded and released music from some of the city's greatest funk and soul acts. Miller's business acumen helped secure national distribution for Lamp releases, allowing groups like the Vanguards to score hits on the national record charts. The catalog of music Lamp recorded stands as an extraordinary document of Indianapolis culture in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And we're going to spin five of those tracks now. Up first, we're going to hear one of my favorite Lamp releases. This is Indianapolis funk legends Amnesty with Everybody Wants to Be Free. My second pick comes from another classic Indianapolis funk group. This is Ebony Rhythm Band with Soul Heart Transplant. In addition to releasing classic funk records, Lamp also issued some fantastic soul vocal groups, including the great Vanguards.
So fine, get away from
Antiques were another excellent Indianapolis vocal group associated with Lamp Records. This is their 1971 release, Fool Am I. Close out with a track from vocalist Funder Cooper. We're going to hear I Didn't Know, which features the late Indianapolis jazz great Billy Wooten on vibes.
Hey, man, that's my wife. What are you doing with her? Don't shoot me. I didn't know she was your one. Hey, hey, don't shoot me.
We just heard five songs from the Indianapolis soul music label, Lamp Records. And you can come out to the 18th annual Nouveau Cultural Vision Awards happening on June 14th at Center Point Brewing to see Lamp Records co-founder Herb Miller awarded for his work in music. Check out nouveau.net for more information.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown and Jill Dittmeyer. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a festival that highlights Israeli films, and a conversation with singer Jackie Ivanko. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.